This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. This week, Charlotte Mayor Patrick Cannon stepped down after being charged with public corruption, crimes including theft and bribery. His resignation was the culmination of a multi-year FBI investigation. Cannon is not the only public official facing criminal investigations this week. Law enforcement officials arrested several public officials in California. They raided offices in New York. Corruption in politics, unfortunately, not a new phenomenon. Here in the studio this week to give us the latest on these developments and much, much more is political junkie Ken Rudin. Welcome to North Carolina, Ken.
Speaking of corruption, welcome. I'm glad to be here.
It's the old-fashioned way here, though. We actually take bags full of money. You know, Jim Black was the House Speaker who literally got a black bag full of money, and that sent him to prison.
Well, the thought of Patrick Cannon sitting in his office getting $20,000 in cash is so Agnew-esque. Remember when Spiro Agnew was Baltimore County Executive and Governor of Maryland and Vice President, there were still bundles of cash being brought into his office.
Well, and American Airlines officials, their lobby was giving black bags full of money literally to the president himself.
I remember this used to happen to you when you were at NPR in Washington.
Just to stay off the air. Now, we should say that all of those things in the past, many of them that we were talking about have actually been proven. They've been through the courts. When we talk about Mayor Cannon, a former Mayor Cannon, these are still allegations in the case of the Charlotte mayor.
True, but the fact is he did resign his post, and usually if you make the case that it's not true, you'll fight and argue it. Mayor Vincent Gray, for example, in Washington, D.C., who's up for renomination in Tuesday's primary, April 1st. I mean, there's a lot of talk about illegal funds, $650,000 illegally funneled into his 2010 campaign. And he's saying, well, these are all lies and I'm not going to resign, even if I am indicted.
All right. So we just want to make the distinction between those stories that are already in the past and ongoing investigations. What does this mean now in terms of there are sting operations all over the country, New York, California, Rhode Island, Washington, D.C., at the moment, all Democrats?
Well, yes. I mean, do I think it's a coincidence? I do. I don't think it's an effort by the U.S. attorneys to get the Democrats. Remember, in 2006, one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House and the Democrats got the majority in the House was this so-called Republican culture of corruption that Nancy Pelosi loved to talk about. Duke Cunningham in California, Mark Foley in Florida. There was a lot. The Abramoff scandals, where so many members of Congress, Conrad Burns, the senator from Montana, Bob Ney of Ohio, they were all implicated in some way in this kind of culture of corruption. So sometimes it helps the Democrats. This time it may help the Republicans. But these are not national figures. I mean, the mayor of Charlotte, the Speaker of the House in Rhode Island, two state senators in California. These are not national figures. But again, if you want to follow a narrative, if you want to create a narrative to talk about this is the party of corruption. Remember the Republicans against Truman, communism, corruption, and Korea. yeah. I mean, you know, it fits into a campaign commercial.
Well, see, the counter is that the Democrats have to take bundles of cash because it's legalized corruption because of the way corporations are allowed to influence races now. So if you've got the Koch brothers on your side, they can do it legally.
Yeah, that is the anti-Koch brothers commercial argument. But I'll tell you one thing, though. The Democrats are obsessed with the Koch brothers because they are putting in millions and millions of dollars, not just to defeat candidates, certainly Kay Hagan is their number one target here in North Carolina, but they also just want to change the way government is being run, and the Koch brothers have the money to do that.
Well, and they've got the Democrats worried, as does Nate Silver, he who predicts things mostly correctly, and is now saying the Republicans have a 60% chance of taking the Senate.
This is the funniest story in the world because first of all, the Democrats, we love Nate Silver. He was exactly accurate in 2008. He predicted the exact number that Obama would get in 2012. We love Nate Silver. Every time we thought that Mitt Romney had a chance of winning, no, we have Nate Silver telling us it's not going to happen. Now Nate Silver is saying the Republicans have a 60% chance of recapturing control of the Senate in November. We hate Nate Silver. I mean, this guy is using Republican strategies and Republican talking points. We hate him. It's just wild that he's become the issue.
He was was much righter than Karl Rove on Fox TV the night of the election when Karl was saying, hold on, hold on, Ohio. Election's not over, right? Now Karl Rove on the other side of that may be behind one of the Senate candidates who replaces a Democrat in Congress.
Well, I thought for a while, I really thought that this election was, or at least the May 6th Republican primary, I thought it was Tom Tillis versus Greg Brennan and then other Republicans. But no, it's Karl Rove versus Rand Paul. It's Mitch McConnell versus Rand Paul. It's the Tea Party versus the establishment. It's just the surrogates in the North Carolina race is just gigantic. But the what's at stake in North Carolina is tremendous as well.
So sort it out for us. Who's behind who? And let's take a look at that race.
You know, it's coming up, the May 6th primary. And obviously, it's crucial if the Republicans are going to win the Senate. We've said this over and over again. They need a net gain of 6 seats. North Carolina, given the fact that Kay Hagan's numbers are not good, given the fact that President Obama's numbers in North Carolina are not good, and there's still a lot of hesitance about the Affordable Care Act. So with all that going on, the Republicans think they have a good shot at knocking off Kay Hagan. I mean, 2008 was one thing when Obama won the state. Kay Hagan beat Elizabeth Dole. Great year for the Democrats. North Carolina politics has certainly turned around in 2010 when they recaptured the, when they captured, not recaptured. If you go back to the 19th
yeah,
century,
recapture 100 years
century,
ago.
Right. If you go back to 2010 when they got the legislature, 2012 the governorship, politics in North Carolina has turned around tremendously. And obviously, which North Carolina shows up in November is the key question.
But if you're at the national level and you're looking at these races, Republicans are certainly worried about candidates who win, who are too far to the right and then aren't as electable, particularly in a purple state like North Carolina when they have to run statewide. So you've got Tom Tillis on the one side who looks a little more moderate than a Brennan on the other. What does this mean at the national level for Republicans at that level looking into North Carolina?
Well, the Republicans were burned in 2010 and 2012. Both times, especially in 2012, they were convinced they had a great opportunity to make major gains in the Senate. But as we saw in 2010 and we saw in 2012, there were a lot of candidates who were just so far conservative, so they may be true to conservative principles, but they had no chance of attracting independent voters in November. So you had the Christine O'Donnell, I am not a witch, in Delaware. You had the Richard Murdoch in Indiana against Dick Lugar. You had Todd Akin in Missouri running against Claire McCaskill. Sharon Angle in Nevada against Harry Reid. These were Tea Party candidates who satisfied the base, but again, turned off so many independent centrist voters, and the Democrats kept those seats.
Right now, Tom Tillis, the front runner in the primary race. He's one who is seen as middle of the road, perhaps.
Wait a second. Let me interrupt for a second. He's a Speaker of the House, probably the most conservative legislature that North Carolina has ever known, and he's become a moderate. Yeah. This shows what's happened to the Republican Party. And I don't say this as a Democrat or to be critical, but the fact is that the thought of Tom Tillis being portrayed as a moderate, given what the legislature has done with voter ID and Medicare and all the and rights and women's reproductive rights, and Tom Tillis is the moderate, the establishment candidate, that just, I mean.
And is he seen as the establishment, and is he a suspect in for Tea Party voters, is he seen as a moderate, and is he a suspect?
Well, anybody who brings in Karl Rove to campaign for him, Karl Rove has a history of saying incendiary things about the Tea Party. He's just criticized their tactics, their candidates they've endorsed in the past, and Karl Rove is more interested in winning, and they want a candidate who could beat Kay Hagan and beat these Democrats around the country. So in that sense, you know, if you bring in a moderate, like a so-called moderate like Karl Rove, you're already suspect. But Tom Tillis is the establishment candidate. And the reason he's the establishment candidate is because Republicans feel he has the best chance of beating Kay Hagan, not because anything's wrong with Greg Brennan or Mark Harris or anybody else. The point is he, on the numbers, on the face of it, he looks like he could win.
Let's go back to Charlotte for a minute and ask if the scandal down there in any way has an influence on these other races in North Carolina.
Charlotte seems to be its own little enclave, and it's hard to make the case that it transfers out into a bigger picture in the state. But, you know, it's interesting. Charlotte mayors have played a big role in political, you know, history. And you think of Governor McCrory, who was the mayor of Charlotte. You think of Harvey Gantt, the 1990 and 1996 Democratic nominee against Jesse Helms. You think of Anthony Fox, who's now in the Obama cabinet, former mayor who could have a future. You think of Sue Myrick, who was the mayor of Charlotte, ran for the Senate, didn't win, but then she wound up in Congress. So Charlotte does have a great opportunity to send a politician either to higher office or, in this case, to possibly to prison.
On the state of things, talking with political junkie Ken Rudin. That conversation will continue. We'll talk about more statewide races and find out a little bit more about the political junkie himself when our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with political junkie Ken Rudin on the latest in North Carolina politics. So let's talk about one of the biggest controversies here in our state now, the coal ash spill. Duke Energy, of course, at the center of this. Governor Pat McCrory, also a longtime employee of that company before he got into politics. Chief legal counsel says that Attorney General Roy Cooper, who is the likely Democratic challenger for the governor's mansion, is using this controversy for his own political gain. Now, that seems like a pretty common thing for a politician to say, right?
It is, and it's usually a charge you see against attorneys general around the country. Kathleen Kane, for example, is the attorney general in Pennsylvania, and the Republicans are saying that she is using the Penn State Joe Paterno scandal to a political benefit. Look, as the attorney general, you have to do investigations, but of course you're going to advance your own political career. Andrew Cuomo was the state attorney general in New York who was talking about corruption on Wall Street. Elliot Spitzer was attorney general in New York, and before he had his own corruption problems. But I mean, basically, yes, you as attorney general, you're going after corruption, you're going after following the law, but at the same time, of course, you're advancing your career. And is the attorney general of North Carolina thinking politics? Of course he is. He's probably, as you say, running for governor against McCrory in 2016, but he's also doing his job.
And there really was a coal ash spill. There really are relationships between attorneys, between former members of the staff on Duke Energy who are now in politics, and Diener as well. And there's a federal investigation going on as well, which is outside the scope of the attorney general's office. I mean, those things are for real and they're actually happening.
They absolutely are. But of course, you know, in politics, we always know perception is reality. And if McCrory is tied to Duke, you know, as he has been, as he was for so many years, you don't need a tremendous leap to have that tie in 2016.
How do these stories play out? You have a problem with an environmental problem with a coal ash spill and these close connections. Is this something that actually has political traction going forward, or does it become, you know, a sort of everybody's in their silos hearing the story the way they want?
Well, a lot also depends on how the government and the governor responds. I mean, look at you know, you could just go back to Hurricane Sandy in New York, New Jersey. Chris Christie became the de facto Republican frontrunner because of his handling. Yes, he embraced President Obama. Yes, a lot of Mitt Romney people didn't like that so much. But at the time, the feeling was that Chris Christie was doing the right thing, cleaning up something that was God's, you know, done by God and not by man. But McCrory has the opportunity to either, you know, come clean, get things done, get things accomplished, and then it doesn't become a political issue. But this is part of what a governor does. You know, it's not like a senator where you just show up and vote. I'm not demeaning what a senator does, but a governor has to be a leader of the state. And an environmental calamity, you could see a governor rise or fall on that.
So we talked earlier about the primary races, but I do want to come back to something which we didn't. We sort of talked about the political dynamics, particularly with the Tea Party on the right. And within the Republican Party. But let's talk about money and the amount of money that's going to go into the Senate race, both the primary and the general election.
Well, you know, Americans for Prosperity, the Koch-founded group, as I said, they're looking at North Carolina as – I don't know if Kay Hagan is the most vulnerable Democrat in the country, but it's certainly more money is being spent in this state than anywhere else. I guess they feel that, their money could make a big difference here. For example, in Alaska, where Mark Begich, the Democrat, is seeking a second term, you only need like $1.50 to really run statewide TV there because it's very inexpensive. North Carolina is an expensive media market. You need a ton of money. But we also saw in 2012 that you know, a lot of Democrats were fretting, and that's when they were loving Nate Silver, but they were fretting that, you know, Mitt Romney had all this money and he was going to buy the election. You could have, you could plaster the media with ads and ads and ads until you're blue in the face, but sometimes the voters get blue in the face too. If you have a good ground game, if you have a good get out the vote effort, sometimes that means much more than you could spend, you know, on TV ads and things like that. So there is a limit to how much money becomes effective, but there's certainly going to be no lack of it in 2014.
You know, it's not legal to buy time on public radio, but if any of you out there want to get your ad on here, I have some investment opportunities for you, and we'll talk about it off the air.
They could just bring in just envelopes with cash, and that's been my maxim for years.
Here in North Carolina, bring me a black bag full of money, and you're on. That's how this thing works. That's how you got on, Ken.
It is. That's true.
That's it.
True.
Which reminds me, you owe me $20. Let's talk about those House races now. Second district incumbent Renee Elmers looks like the front runners. That is a very red district, right?
It never used to be. I mean, when she first was elected in the 2010 Tea Party sweep, she barely won, but then they made the district much more red. I mean, we could talk about Clay Aiken and Keith Cisco until we're blue in the face, but the point is, it's hard to imagine a Republican losing this district unless, you know, Renee Elmers suddenly fell in the primary to a Tea Party opponent, but I can't see that happening.
And she's been a darling of the Tea Party for a long time.
Again, it's a Tom Tillis kind of thing. She's very, very conservative, but maybe she voted one way or said something about immigration that just, you know, upset some people in the Tea Party, and suddenly she's suspect.
We talked about the Senate race, Tom Tillis and Greg Brannon, his challenger in the primary.
Before we leave that primary, I just want to say that the Republicans, as I say, think Kay Hagan is so vulnerable, but not if Tillis is forced into a runoff, which is in mid-July.
I was going to ask you if you thought there'd be a runoff.
Oh, I'll wait for your question then.
That's it. My question to you, Ken.
Yeah?
You think there'll be a runoff in that primary?
Well, see, that's the thing. Obviously, if Tillis doesn't get the 40% on May 6th, he does. And that's the worst thing, the last thing the Republicans want, because they want to take on Hagan right away. They don't want to wait. But Tea Party people will say, and with some justification, you have to earn our vote. You have to earn the nomination. And again, in North Carolina, if you don't get the 40%, you're pushed into a runoff. But the Republican establishment doesn't want to spend all that time and all that money fighting among themselves. They'd rather just take on Hagan on May 7th.
Can't they, in the runoff race, just make it all about Hagan and who's more likely to win? I mean, they can still aim the entire campaign at her.
You've just defined the conflict in the Republican Party. Do you want somebody who can win, or do you want somebody who will stand up for conservative principles? I'm not making the argument that Tillis is not a conservative, but the Tea Party will say, I'd rather have a Greg Brannon who maybe he can, maybe he can't beat her, but he's more true to conservative principles.
You talked about Clay Aiken in that race. He's one of the challengers, one of the Democratic challengers in the second district, who is would meet the likely winner in the Republican side, Renee Elmers. What about that? Is there anything about star power that gives him a better chance in that race?
I don't know. I mean, you know, of course, he's never run for office before, but that's not unusual. Elizabeth Dole never ran for office, too, and she won a Senate seat in 2002. So, I mean, things can happen, but he has a national figure, has a national name, and we know he probably could raise some bucks. I don't know how much money he is raising, and you know, the fact is the primary is coming up very, very soon, a month and a half or 5-6 weeks, something like that. So, it's questionable what the Democratic nomination in the second district is worth, but certainly the fact is he's a national figure who could raise national money. But again, Keith Cisco, you know, does have roots in North Carolina. They both have roots in North Carolina, of course, but Cisco has been more involved in North Carolina politics. We'll see.
Heath Shuler, a celebrity candidate from Western North Carolina, a very bad quarterback for the Washington Redskins, as you know, while we were there.
Right, which is good news.
Was a
Giants
really,
fan.
Really horrible quarterback.
Didn't he?
He won, though. He became a congressman.
Yeah, yes, and he's no longer a congressman.
And then he lost.
As I recall, didn't he celebrate a touchdown by smashing his head against
That was Gus Frerotte. That was Gus Frerotte.
It was Gus Frerotte.
Gus Frerotte, who was the fill-in. He came in behind. Heath Shuler could not throw the deep out, and I don't know why they didn't see that in the camp.
Yeah.
Now back to our show. You know,
now back to Earth.
Let's talk about the sixth district. Well, I'll talk to you more about Gus Frerotte. Yeah, he filled in and did a good job for a minute, and then was
Frerotte was the one who hit his head. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
Sixth district, lots of Republicans there, nine candidates in that race. Tell us about that, please.
There were two seats you want to look at in North Carolina, the 6th, where Howard Coble is retiring, and the 12th, where Mel Watt left to join the Obama administration. Neither one is going to leave its incumbent party. Obviously, the primary is the key story there. But again, once upon a time, when Howard Coble was first elected, you know, it was just a marginally Republican district. Now it's solidly Republican. The same thing with the 12th with Mel Watt, solidly Democratic seat. There are a lot of complaints, I know, though, that there is no special election in the 12th. It's going to be without an incumbent until the November general election. But both the 6th and 12th really are not much to pay attention to, because it won't change the dynamic of who's controlling the Congress.
What about this particular midterm election coming as it does in the second term of President Obama's campaign, or his presidency, right? 6 years in. You talked about something like something called the six-year itch.
Well, it doesn't always happen, but historically, the sixth year of the party that's in the White House, they suffer in those midterm elections. For example, in 1958, 6 years into the Eisenhower administration, the Democrats won a tremendous victory in 58. Republicans got routed. In 1966, with Lyndon Johnson president and the Vietnam War going on and unrest in the streets, that was 6 years of Democratic rule, Kennedy and then Johnson. In 1966, Republicans picked up 47 seats in the House. 6 years into the Nixon administration, in 1974, by then it was Gerald Ford, but it was 6 years of the Republican Party. Of course, you had Watergate, but you also had the Republican Party wiped out. It happens. We've seen it happen over and over again. 2006, a perfect example. 6 years into George W. Bush, you had Iraq, you had Katrina, you had high prices and all that stuff, but the Republicans paid the price. The one administration that – are we still recording? The one administration – are we on the air? the one break in this panel came in 1998 when it was 6 years in Bill Clinton, but because the Republican Party and Newt Gingrich overreached with Monica Lewinsky and all the Clinton scandals, the voters said, wait a second, this is just too much. And the Democratic Party actually picked up seats, but that is a true aberration.
And you had unprecedented economic progress over that period as well. I mean, that's the sort of the other side of it. So if you look at things like Watergate as kind of mitigating circumstances in 76 and then Iraq in 2006.
But that's a good point. I mean, 1958, bad economy. Yep. Eisenhower and Republicans paid the price. 2006, the economy was starting to falter. Prices were going up. Gasoline prices going through the roof. And the Republican Party paid the price in 2006.
So Affordable Care Act, obviously that looked like it was going to be a huge disaster for any Republican, any Democrat running in this cycle. Things have turned around. They fixed the computers, and the stories more and more are about the millions of people who now have health insurance. Is that going to be a story? Will that be the story that's told come November?
Well, sometimes when you have when the script is already written, even though the story may be changing, it may not have changed soon enough for the Democrats. And as a perfect example, in 1992, we know the Democrats were running on it's the economy stupid, and the Bush economy, senior Bush economy, was doing really poorly. In the fall of 1992, the economy actually was improving, but it was in so many voters' minds that it's been so bad for so long that I'm just going to take out my ire on the GOP and vote for the Democrats. We don't know how the Affordable Care Act will play as an issue in November, but we do know that a couple of weeks ago we saw that special election in Florida where the Democrat was favored to win. He had an exceptional Democratic candidate, and the Republicans wanted running against Obamacare. We've seen the Republicans in North Carolina throwing Kay Hagan's words back at it. If you like your insurance plan, you can keep your insurance plan, which, of course, many Democrats said because President Obama said it. When that turned out to be not true, you saw a lot of Democrats backtracking. We don't want to repeal. We don't want to defund the Affordable Care Act, but we want to make changes. We want to fix it. So voters, the polls still show that it's unpopular. Look, the Obama numbers are not great. 41, 42, 43% are not great numbers. Now, when you think of Bill Clinton in the midterm in 6 years, he was riding high, perhaps as a reaction to what the Republicans were doing. But the Obama numbers are not good, and that can help the Democratic Party. So, yes, the Republicans do sound like Johnny One Note. I'm going to just talk about Obamacare until the cows come home.
Until they're red in the face.
Exactly, right. Not blue in the face, exactly. Because it wouldn't be the cows come home, because that would be utter nonsense. Yes, but anyway, but so the point is that if as long as they think it works, Frank, you still with me? As long as they still think it works, they'll stay with it.
Let's switch gears a little bit, Ken, because everybody loves you, and it's so great to have you on the air here. And how long have you been interested in politics?
It was the 1966 elections.
That's
true. This is true.
You would know the date, too.
It's true. And I was only 6 months old. And what I would do is I would write to all the guys, the people, the guys and gals, mostly guys back then, who were running for governor and senator. George Wallace, George Romney, Nelson Rockefeller, Ronald Reagan. And I said, you know, send me campaign buttons. I love, you know, I love you. I love this. I love that, blah, blah, blah. Pat Brown, all that stuff. And they would all send me these campaign buttons. Matter of fact, Ronald Reagan, of course, didn't send me a button, but his administrative assistant, Edwin Meese, sent me a button, and I still have that letter. So I would collect campaign buttons, and I just loved politics. And I've never been an advocate. I've never been a D or an R or an L. But I love politics the way I love baseball. Well, I do have partisanship in baseball. But I love the history. I love the trivia. I love the lore. I love the great stories. And in my 2 decades of working for NPR, I had the fortune, and I'm blessed with it, to have gone around the country, talked to people who love politics, who love to talk about, you know, I mean, we on your show a few weeks ago, for example, we were talking about the President Obama and Zach Galifianakis amusing back and forth, and which was fun. And I wrote on my website or Facebook page that, well, that's all fine and good, but remember, Zach Galifianakis' uncle, Nick Galifianakis, ran against Jesse Helms in 1972. He ran for Congress. He was elected to Congress. I must have gotten 25 to 30 emails from people who said, my parents still sing the Nick Galifianakis theme song. What I love about the politics is not so much, look, are things great now? Are things in Congress great now? They're awful. But there are stories there. There are people, there are great people of the past who we should cherish and remember, and that's what I get the great joy out of.
Were you? You're always, and for anybody, and I've known you for a long time, and I will say, if you think Ken knows a lot about politics, ask him about baseball. You've got like a head full of statistics, and you're really strong there. I mean, you can pull up a date, pull up a time, and then tell the story about it. When you asked for those buttons when you were a little kid and sent out all those letters, I mean, were you following the issues, or is it a kind of a statistical thing for you? What really grabs you in politics?
I have never been accused of being a big issue person. I mean, obviously in 66, it was Vietnam and it was civil strife and unrest on the college campuses. In 1974, for example, when Nixon was about to be pulled down on Watergate, I wrote to Jerry Voorhees. He was the congressman Nixon beat in 1946 when Nixon first came to the House. I said, do you have any campaign buttons? And we had this conversation and this relationship that went on for quite some time, talking about what was politics like in 1946, the anti-Truman mood in 1946. And so, look, I am a collector. I love the horse race, but I love the stories. I love the people who were part of it, and it just gives me great joy. And I think the people who experience this firsthand love to talk about it as well.
They do, and they love to talk about it with you, and I'm so happy you're here. Ken Rudin, thanks so much for being
here. Thank you, Frank.
Well, Ken, you talked about Nick Galifianakis' theme song, his campaign song. We'll take you back even farther now when the grandson of President William Henry Harrison ran for office. His political opposition thought that perhaps his hat was too big for his head. He was running on his grandfather's name and reputation, and young Ben Harrison didn't have the stuff that it took, according to his opposition. So they created this song to the theme of My Grandfather's Clock that talked about his hat being too big for his head.
His hat is too big for his head, but Ben tries it on just the same. It fits him too quick, which has oft times been said with regard to his grandfather's fame. It was bought long ago, and it made a pretty show in that jolly hard cider campaign. But it don't fit, even a little bit, on Benjamin Harrison's brain.
There it is. Your hat's too big for your head. The opposition to Ben Harrison. And that was the theme song that helped undo his political career. Ken Rudin, thank you very much for being with us. The Political Junkie joins us regularly on The State of Things. And you can find out more about The Political Junkie and his scuttle button puzzle on our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Clockwork Kid. Stay tuned.
Magdalena.